Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. 9/11 taught us that dramatic images have an impact on young people and that the impact can take an emotional toll. Images from Ferguson have been dramatic. A body lying in the street, tear gas, looting, fire. It will be left to parents and educators to deal with the consequences among the very young, preteens, and older kids. We'll be talking about those consequences and how to deal with them on today's program. Joining me in studio, Tom Lawson is a social studies teacher and chair of the social studies department at McClure High School in the Ferguson-Florissant district. The opening of school in that district has been delayed because of the Ferguson violence. Steve Zwolak heads the University City Children's Center. Greg Carr is an instructor at Harris Stowe State University and adjunct at Florissant Valley and the University of Missouri St. Louis. Gentlemen, thanks so much for being with us. Great to have you.
Good morning.
Thank you.
You all represent various groups that you teach, younger at various age levels, I should say. So let me start with you, Steve, because you have the youngest group primarily, and ask what your concerns are about the way these images and these messages from Ferguson are being received among the young kids.
Yeah. I mean, it's really critical. I mean, in early childhood, a child's most important issue is safety. And they need to be physically safe, emotionally safe, and socially safe. And what's happening as they see these images time and time again, it projects that we're not safe. And what's critical time right now is for us to be able to say, you are safe. But the images are saying something completely different. So there's an interesting paradox. And what we know about early childhood is that the kids, what they see is what it is.
And sometimes what they see is in their front yard because the real world is closing in on them from time to time.
That's right.
Right. So, Tom Lawson, let me turn to you. You're dealing with a somewhat older group, high school kids. What are your concerns about how they're receiving this stuff?
Well, one of my biggest concerns, and I think many of my colleagues would say, is that the sensationalism of the media itself. There's a lot of stuff that comes out from different groups. And, you know, when you talk to a lot of the people who are in Ferguson, they're seeing what reality is, and they're quite shocked as to what's really being portrayed by outside people and where other people from different countries are seeing it. And I think one of the things that's going to happen is when our students come in on Monday, is that they're going to have all these questions about, did you hear this? Did you hear that? What's going on? And they're going to have all these questions, and they're going to look to, you know, the staff at McClure and other high schools and other schools in our district, you know, for additional information. They're going to want that need to know. And so I think that's going to be the biggest issue.
This is a teaching moment for you, certainly.
It's a teaching moment in every aspect, not only about how to deal with personal situations that are taking place, but also civics and just the crisis situation. Mm-hmm.
Greg Carr, your group is a little bit older, but you do have a 13-year-old son, I understand. Is
yes,
that correct?
I do.
Let's talk about the students that you deal with, and we'll also talk in a bit about your son.
The students that I deal with, Don, I think are going to be conflicted about their position on what they should do about the situation, because many of the students I'm going to deal with are very close in age to Michael Brown. There'll be 18-year-olds and 19-year-olds, and some of our students from Harris Stowe State University, we discussed this morning in a faculty orientation, possibly graduated with Michael Brown and knew him personally, so they have a personal stake in it. So we're helping them to separate, as Tom said, the sensationalism, because we know they're going to be very emotional, but we also want to teach them how to think logically and rationally through this very difficult crisis.
Well, Tom, as I understand it, in Ferguson-Florissant, special training is already underway to help teachers deal with what they're going to find on Monday.
Yeah, today, throughout our district, we did a training called RISE, which is Response, Intervention, Support, and Education. And through the support of counseling services with UMSL, we had people come out and help us identify perhaps behavior that stress might be causing. And so we got a lot of information on how to identify, how we can go about supporting our students by sending them down. We got additional psychologists coming in, especially from the Great Circle counselors in the special school district. We usually have 24 counselors on staff, but we're going to have additional 33. So I think we're prepared.
Steve, you're dealing again with a much younger group, and I suppose there could be more dramatic results amongst the very young.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I did the kickoff address to the early childhood teachers for Ferguson Florissant a week and a half ago, and we talked about the concept of mirroring and what this event is doing. When children are seeing these images, they begin to look at these mirroring effects are occurring. So they're seeing things, and they're assimilating things in a very obtuse way. And so what we talk to teachers about is how do we provide the safety for children by reiterating the necessity for lap time, for closeness. How do we facilitate child-to-child interactions differently to try to mitigate the fact that there's chaos outside of them? So for early childhood, we need to be able to provide more opportunities for kindness and gentility through a very organic manner, because they don't necessarily get what's going on outside.
So. Have you experienced that yet? I mean, have the kids reacted to this point?
You know, it was interesting. We had a story yesterday with one of our teachers. This little boy said, Michael Brown was killed, a 4.5-year-old. Michael Brown was killed. And there were and he talked about three witches. So what that told us as an early childhood educator is he unleashed something that he wasn't sure about. What does Michael Brown being killed mean to him? And it was too much too soon for him, so he went to his fantasy world in the same sentence. Mm. That's what early childhood kids will do. They will seep it, let us know, and then go to a safe place. And as an early childhood person, we need to go in and support the emotional framework and use the fantasy of the three witches to help uncover what he's really trying to get to with Michael Brown being killed.
Are you talking about three witches, as in women who fly on a broom? Is that the kind of witch
you're talking
about?
Right, yeah.
Well, that's scary in its own right.
Yeah, but that's what they can control. That's his fantasy. Michael Brown is not a fantasy. That's a reality of something that he heard and saw, and that's too much for him. So children, when they get overwhelmed, and that's trauma, when they get overwhelmed with trauma, they will retreat into a safe place. So the safe place with him was his fantasy about three witches.
Greg Carr, how does that strike you? You have a 13-year-old.
I have a 13-year-old with a great imagination. And my wife and I have raised them to be very realistic. As we talked about on the NPR interview yesterday, we've begun giving him the talk that is now known as. But we've also been equipping him with history. And one of the things that we discussed, ironically, and it seems like all these things have kind of come to a head, I was watching the documentary Eyes on the Prize the night before Michael Brown was killed, and we looked at the Emmett Till section of the documentary, and I told Greg, I said, Greg, I want you to see this, and I want you to know something. I said, when Emmett Till was killed, he was 14 years old. He was only 1 year older than you. I said, so I want you to be aware. I said, you know, Mom and I want you to be safe, right? He says, I know. I said, well, I want you to go talk to your mom about what you just saw. And he said he was very upset, but he said he wasn't scared. But it still upset him, he said, because he was so young. So why did that have to happen? So we said, as a family, we're going to sit down and watch the entire documentary so we can get a historical understanding. And I think once we start to put things together historically, we get a bigger picture. I'm a big social media person. I just checked on my Facebook page, and I saw the most wonderful painting of Emmett Till with his hands over his eyes, Trayvon Martin with his hands over his mouth, and Michael Brown with his hands over his ears.
Hear no evil, see no evil,
yes,
speak no evil.
Yes, and it was very powerful, and because I'm also an artist. I'm a writer, and I'm actually working with individuals at UMSL to put together some artists so we can actually do some performances to benefit the family, but also so for people can get a therapeutic feeling about performance art.
How is your son responding to the Ferguson story and the images that we've been talking about?
He's been very philosophical about it, and he's been very analytical. My son's very analytical. If you hear the interview, he's very, very deep-thinking young man. He's very analytical. He said, Dad, what does the robbery, the so-called robbery, have to do with him getting shot? He said, I don't understand the correlation. And I looked at him, I said, whoa, that's a big word. He said, yeah, Dad, I don't see the correlation. He said, I think that was to try to make Michael Brown look bad. He said, I don't like that. And so he said, I don't think that's fair. So he actually saw the parallel without even being prompted.
And Steve, what kinds of questions are you hearing?
Well, and I just really want to dovetail in is what he said was, as a family, and I think that's the key piece, as a family, we have family values, and it's an opportunity from very early on is to help children understand your own family values. Mm-hmm. And that language and that conversation taking place within the family is really critical. At 3, 4, and 5, it's not too young to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. And to be able to say, and as my kids were growing up, I would say to the girls, you're Zwolax, and this is what Zwolax do. Mm-hmm. And I think that is the powerful message. And it gives them the resiliency and the emotional safe harbor to know that I can go home and talk to mommy and daddy mm-hmm. about the issues outside the world that are bigger than me and scarier. And the younger they are, the scarier. And I also think that middle school kids have that fantasy world, too, and there's yes. a lot of other fabrication that go on. Mm-hmm. So
I think Greg makes a really good point in that what you're really talking about is two different things, being upset and being scared. And I think at the high school level, I think what we're really going to experience a lot is a lot of people being scared. Mm-hmm. And because you made a good point earlier, too, is that many of these people, you know, with Michael actually had attended McClure, from what I've been told, and that, you know, we might even have some students who know him personally, mm-hmm. live in the apartment complex in the neighborhood and stuff like that, and those are the ones who are going to be really, really upset about things. And I think what they're going to want to know is what is the process? What's happening? And one of the things that we can do within our department is talk about what is the due process? What is civic responsibility? Mm-hmm. What is going to happen? Because if we take a look at the sensationalism of the Rodney King, all you saw is that video over and over again, but nobody understood what they were seeing. Right. And I think that's probably the responsibility of the social studies department at McClure High School is to explain what is going on and what they are seeing and how to receive all that information.
After our break, we're going to be talking with an educator from this area who doesn't want his teachers talking about this. It's a rather interesting approach to it, and that'll be coming up after the break. But Tom, I want to come back to you with regard to what the crisis management people have told you to look for. I mean, if kids don't verbalize what they're feeling, and sometimes they don't in that particular age group, do you have cues that you can look for to determine whether or not they need some help?
I think one of the first things you can do is just kind of get a feel, just by keeping your ears open. That's the greatest thing to do is to let them come. If they're upset, they're going to vocalize it. I think the students in our school are very good in communicating with our staff and our teachers. And I think once they can open up and feel that connection, that they can approach a teacher, regardless of math teacher or a social studies teacher or whatever it is, I think that's where we're going to start identifying some of the things. So by just keeping our ears open, that's the first thing. The next thing is that we can see perhaps the lack of confidence in themselves. Or perhaps the way they kind of do a lot more put downs than put ups, talking about how crazy things are, or maybe how bad things are. And so by hearing those kind of negativities, I think that's a cue right there. And then of course, there's the more deep involved ones that have more of a connection with what's going on. And those are the people who are going to be kind of upset. They may be withdrawn, or we just may get some kind of signals from other students saying that, you know, so-and-so is really upset about this. And then we can kind of help guide them into, you know, some help.
I don't want to put you on the spot here, but do you think it's a good idea to have withheld the opening of school during all this process? Or might the kids have been better served if they had had someplace to go?
That's a really good question.
If you don't want to answer it,
you've got to think about the safety and not knowing what's going to transpire during the day or what's going to transpire at night. For example, we're planning to have school on Monday. Well, Michael Brown's funeral is on Monday. Mm-hmm. What is that going to do? Is there going to be a procession that's going to go through? Because of, you know, financial cutbacks, you know, many of our students have to walk to school. And so, you know, how's that going to play into things? Are parents going to be concerned about that? We've had Desi come in. We've had Local authorities come in, and constantly through communications with our district, you know, we all come to an understanding and an agreement of, you know, what's best. And so I think the decision that we postponed, I think, was a good decision.
Yeah. I also know, however, that the psychologists will tell you that the best way to relieve stress is to maintain a routine.
Well, we're going to have that routine on Monday.
Routine will come back on Monday. I have to take a break. We'll do that now. We're talking about the impact on the situation in Ferguson amongst young people. My guests in studio are Greg Carr, instructor at Harris Stowe State University, Tom Lawson, from whom you just heard, is a social studies teacher at McClure High School in the Ferguson-Florissant District, and Steve Zwolak is with us, head of the University City Children's Center. We'll come back, continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We'll be continuing our conversation on the impact of the situation in Ferguson on young people in just a moment, but here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. Multiple news conferences are scheduled for today by groups calling for St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCullough to step down from the investigation of the Mike Brown fatal police shooting. And as we've mentioned, teachers from the Ferguson-Florissant School District spent this morning in training on how to deal with students upset by the events in Ferguson over the last 10 days. The start of classes in the district was delayed until Monday. And Illinois is getting $300 million from a national settlement with the Bank of America over the 2008 mortgage meltdown. Attorney General Lisa Madigan says the deal includes $200 million to fully recover losses incurred by Illinois' pension systems and $100 million in consumer relief. You can learn more about these and other stories this afternoon on St. Louis Public Radio and throughout the day at stlpublicradio.org. Now, back to our conversation with Greg Carr, Steve Zwolak, and with Tom Lawson. Greg, let me come back to you again, reference to your son, and I hope you don't mind my doing this, but it's so relevant. You talk about having the talk. What do you say in the talk?
Don, what we say in the talk is you have to be aware of history. And like I said, I'm a big history person, and I, to kind of coattail on what Steve was saying about the family narrative, I wanted to pass down wisdom from my son's grandfather, my father, a man from Kentucky, a man from the South, who said to us in 1977 when we were pulled over, my older brother Daryl was driving. We were going to Kentucky Lake, and we were in Cairo, Illinois. And Cairo, Illinois, as many of us know, is not very friendly. And I've worked in Southern Illinois. It's a different kind of place. And so when we were pulled over, my brother was very nervous. He had just gotten his license, but my father was giving him a chance, and he told him, said, "Now you stay calm." And before the policeman got there, he said, "You give him your license. You say yes, sir. You say no, sir. You don't raise your voice. Whatever he does, just stay calm." And the young policeman, he couldn't have been any more than 24 years old, said, "Boy, do you know how fast you're going?" Everything was "boy," and he leaned over to my father, said, "Boy, is this your truck?" And everything, every other word was "boy." And my father just continued to smile and say, "No, sir. Yes, sir. This is my truck. No, sir." He's a 16-year-old, and all of us were fuming in the back seat because we said, "My father's not a boy. He's a man. Why is he?" But he kept waving for us to be quiet. And so when I saw the movie The Great Debaters, there's a scene like that in The Great Debaters in which Forrest Whitaker's character hits a pig on a side road, and he tells his son to stay in the back seat. I said, "I know that scene. I've been in that film before." And so I explained to him from a historical context, historically, African Americans have not been treated fairly in the criminal justice system, and particularly with law enforcement. So I said, "I think I would be remiss if I didn't tell you what your grandfather told me and your uncle." So I said, "But I want to tell it in your language." I said, "Do you understand where I'm coming from?" So I said, "I know you're from the technological generation. So we're going to look at some videos. We watch some YouTube clips. And as I said before, we're going to continue to watch the Eyes on the Prize video." So also for him to know his rights, because my son is very vocal. So we're going to teach him what rights he has as well.
You know, I think of that Chris Rock piece, which a lot of people don't like, but how young black men should deal with the police. It's very funny, but it's very true.
Very truthful.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, we'll refer folks to YouTube and Google for that if they want to pick up more.
Yes.
Steve Zwolak, what is the responsibility of the educator in dealing with issues like this, do you see?
Well, I think I need to go back into the world of early childhood. Yeah. It is absolutely critical that we help children understand how to build relationships. and I think we've gone awry with that. Children need to build relationships and know how to get along with each other, and that happens very early on. The issues around diversity don't start at kindergarten. They start in infancy, and they start around 9 months of age when children, when babies understand others outside of self. So we have the foundations to build a responsible educational community in the world of early childhood. Kids who understand how to build relationships through attachments, they will then have the ability, the number one indicator for academic success is self-control, which is a key element in early childhood. And so we need to have kids developing attachments, self-control, and then they develop the ability to develop initiative, which means that they can think for themselves based on a foundation that is emotionally sound. And if we keep thinking that we're going to teach to the head, and I mean, we can teach anybody ABCs, 1, 2, 3, but it's the core element of personhood around is attachment, self-control, and the ability to develop initiative.
Tom Lawson, my father used to say, as the twig is bent, so grows the tree. Following up on what Steve has just said, is it really too late when a kid is 16, 17, 18 years old?
I'm an optimist. No, I don't think it's too late. I think, especially in our district, we took the initiative called PBIS, which is Positive Behavior and Support, Intervention and Support, and we've got recognitions by the state for that program. And I think it's just learning takes place all the time. And I think it's just an aspect of building that relationship with your students and communicating what's transpiring, and then say, okay, let's take a look and what can we do differently next time?
I raised that question because I talked earlier today with Dr. Ed Hightower, who is the superintendent of the Edwardsville, Illinois School District. As some of you may have seen in the media, he has asked his staff to avoid discussion of Ferguson, the situation in Ferguson, in classes. And not everybody agrees with that thing, to avoid the discussion. But this came up after last Friday and Monday's classes. And he made the point of how saddened everybody is about what happened. But he doesn't want discussion of it in the classroom. Let's hear what he had to say.
We had teachers attempting to discuss with their students the emotional issues surrounding the shooting of Michael Brown. An African-American student being shot by a Caucasian police officer. In all cases, it created hard feelings to the point where students and parents began contacting my office and the high school principal. We talked about it, and a decision was made with the amount of tension and emotions, anger, and unknown facts that exist at that time. We needed to postpone any attempts right then of trying to mediate or moderate or carry on discussions with 15, 16, 17-year-old students, okay? We are not in any way saying that this should not happen. There must be a discussion held objectively, but it must be without adding polarizing opinions.
Whose opinions are you concerned about? Your instructors? The instructors, the students, media?
These were incidents involving teachers and students. Students went home, and I'm not going to say that everything that the students reported from some teachers were accurate. I won't say that, but I do know that, again, it created an issue that was going to become problematic if we did not get a handle around it. And certainly, Don, if I had it to do over again, you know, and we never squelched the notion that you can't talk about this. We were encouraging them. We talked to several, we talked to those parents, we talked to those teachers and said that, hey, we need to do a better job of laying out the framework for these discussions to take place.
Well, if you had it to do over again, you do. You could change your edict right now.
In what sense?
in what sense, and just allow the discussion to take place.
Oh,
a lot of people look at this.
That's what we are working right now with the teachers to develop a framework for them to use.
Would you agree that regardless of how you're looking at it now, that this is a teaching moment?
I agree. But when you've got a group of students who do not see this as a teaching moment, but see this as teachers are being biased in their comments, whether they're true or not, whether what they reported is accurate. And when I've got parents who are saying that teacher had no right to say what he or she said to my kid today, it creates a bigger issue here.
Do you have any concerns, Dr. Hightower, that the kids might go elsewhere for information, and using social media perhaps, which is not always accurate, relying on each other and, relying on people outside your system?
Well, that is happening anyway. That a lot of that is the misinformation that is out there. The factual information is not known. There's only one fact, and it took days for that factual information to come out, and that was there were 6 shots fired.
Well, I'm not sure I'm following you here in this logic. The kids are getting this information. They're getting all of the information, and a lot of it is bogus information. And here is an opportunity, it would seem to me, with the instructors who are following this more mature and, better able perhaps to evaluate what's going on, to really set the record as straight as is possible under these conditions.
How would they set the record straight, Don? They attempted to set the record straight on Friday and again on Monday, and the discussions went downhill and became very volatile.
If you are not shutting down discussion, what is telling teachers to avoid discussion?
For the moment, we needed to do that.
And that moment persists through today.
That moment is just about over. The last 2 nights over in Ferguson, Florida, it's been a lot calmer. It's been a lot quieter. We will be getting directions in the hands of our teachers by the first of next week. Working with those teachers and letting them agree upon the framework in which discussions could be held at this time.
Does this reflect in any sense a lack of confidence in your teacher's ability?
No, not at all. It does not, Don.
Well, give me some sort of a timeline. Suppose more violence breaks out. We're all hoping that doesn't happen.
Well, that's what we're hoping for.
Of course.
And that's exactly what we're hoping for.
But if it does?
I can't read tomorrow, Don, and I won't attempt, as you cannot.
Any regrets over having taken this path?
Well, again, if I had to do it over, there's one regret, and I will be honest, as I've always, the statement, and I've got the statement right here in front of me. It says here, refrain from discussing. It should have been, if I had to do over again, I would take out the word discussing, but injecting personal opinions to students, that can't be. You can't involve your personal opinions in this discussion as it stands right now because, again, the facts are unknown.
That's Dr. Ed Hightower, superintendent of schools in the Edwardsville, Illinois School District. Dr. Hightower is between a rock and a hard place, I think. At least he certainly feels that he is. Yeah, Greg Carr, your thoughts about the approach he's taken.
Well, first of all, I respect Dr. Hightower's position because he is ultimately responsible for that school district. However, if I were in Dr. Hightower's shoes, I would do something I did last night at Florissant Valley Community College. I realized that I was basically going into the heart of a very pained area. And when I showed up, I purposefully showed up a few minutes early, and I could see and assess the emotion on many of the people's faces. I mean, if it's the first day of class, there's already a certain amount of trepidation anyway. But then we had this whole situation on top of it, and I just opened up by introducing myself and saying what we wanted to do. But I said, I want to acknowledge the moment. I said, let's take a moment of silence to recognize what happened. And I think I did something that maybe even shocked myself, and I think it really set the tone for the class. I said, we're going to have a moment of silence, not only for Michael Brown, but for Darren Wilson also, because they're both inextricably tied now. And these families are both grieving over what happened. And then I began to talk about my personal experiences living close and working in Ferguson. You know, when I used to work for Enterprise Rent a Car, I work right there in Delwood, frequent a lot of the restaurants there. And then I had my students write down their feelings. And I didn't necessarily want them to begin to express them, so I put them into pairs, and they began to talk with one another. And I felt that that was a sense of reestablishing some normalcy. And then we went on with the rest of the class. But I felt like we had to acknowledge it for that moment and incrementally have that conversation.
And what kinds of things, as briefly as you can do that, were they saying in their compositions?
Some of them were upset. Many of them said, I now want to go into law enforcement. Hmm. That was a narrative I kept hearing over and over. And one young man was in my class, and he actually had a badge on. He's in law enforcement. And so he said, I wrote in my paper why I want to get out of law enforcement now. Hmm. Because he said, now I see this is not what I really want to do. So I think writing is very therapeutic, and I think it's an excellent way for them to express themselves in a safe place.
No question about that. Steve Zwolick?
Well, Dr. Martin Luther King said, a riot is the language of the unheard. Mm-hmm. And we have people who have generational voicelessness. And what we encourage in your world of early childhood is help children develop their voice. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the paradox of all of this. So we're trying to develop voice, and then there are people, generations where they don't have a voice. I think that's a real serious issue for us.
Tom Lawson, is discussing it therapeutic, do you think?
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I think anybody who goes through any kind of crisis or trauma or something that's quite unusual for their lifestyle or their environment, I think people need to talk about it. I think to sidestep it is just saying, I'm not going to acknowledge it. And that's not appropriate.
Yeah, Steve.
But there is an important piece, and I think what the superintendent is saying, when we impose so much of our own values in it, and I think this is a conversation for teachers. We bring our baggage into the classroom. Mm-hmm. How do we sort our baggage out from the facts? I think that's a reality.
Right.
But that needs to be an overt kind of conversation.
That's clearly where he's coming from. We have a number of calls. I'd like to get to as many of them as time allows. So let's begin with David calling from Shiloh in Illinois. David, go ahead. You're on the air.
Thank you.
Go ahead.
Since you're talking about family values and people growing up, I think people of any age could appreciate the fact that in North County, you have a young lady that was jailed because she allegedly killed the dog, jailed to the point that she even missed her grandmother's funeral. Now, you have this killing of this young man. They allowed him to lie in the streets for at least 4 hours under the guise of not disturbing the crime scene. But the policeman was part of the crime scene, and they hustled him away. Add to the fact that all these excuses are being made for policemen, the stress that they're under. I was a volunteer in the military during the Vietnam era. I felt that I had a greater call to exercise certain kinds of orders than those who were drafted. If the job is too tough, then you don't need to be in that profession.
David, thank you for the call. I'm going to cut you off here because our time is getting away from us, and I want folks here to react to something you said initially, getting back to our point about how kids react to this. Let's just talk about the body in the street. I mean, it was out there for 4 hours, and it was on television throughout the night and many times since then. How do kids react to that? Thoughts?
I could begin. I had the opportunity. At Harris Stowe, we have our president, Dr. Dwan Womack, is really establishing Harris Stowe as a think tank. So we're going to be having more. In fact, we had a community forum last night that invited individuals from MSNBC and local leaders to talk about it. But one of the things that I did when I went to our forum on Sunday night, I saw one of my former students from Harris Stowe, and she hugged me and she said, Mr. Carr, I've been in jail. I went to jail the other night. And so she said, I was in jail with a 67-year-old man and a 60-year-old woman. And he said, she said, I felt like I was back in the civil rights movement. And the only reason why they were there is because they were handicapped and they couldn't get away from the police. But they were happy to be there with me. So to have one of my students who was there and said she felt what the people were feeling. She was at the protest. And she said many of us were peaceful. So there were peaceful protesters, but there were also intermingled individuals who we've discovered weren't even from the Ferguson area. They were causing a lot of the problems. And once we start to sort the peaceful protesters from the rioters and the looters, then we can actually have a good conversation.
Steve Zwolak, it occurs to me that young people and the group that you deal with primarily, seeing a body in the street is an awful thing when it's a real body, but they see it all the time on television anyway.
Well,
or, you know, on programming.
And I'll go back to media. We need to keep the TV off for our young children because they don't see it. When you think of a four-year-old, how they play, bang, bang, you're dead. They fall over, they get back up. So what a conflict this creates for children when they are hearing and seeing, although they don't understand time like we do, and nor are they watching it for 4 hours. But I think the concept of dead to them is they play dead. And that's part of their play. They are working through all their fantasies that way. So I think it's a challenge.
Yeah. And Tom, your group, a little more realistic about that, because some of them, I'm sure, have seen the real thing in the streets.
Yeah. I do want to say that I appreciate David's perspective and the fact that he is, you know, seeing something like this, and he's got genuine feelings about it, where we're so kind of desensitized with the violence on TV. And just when we have fights between our high school students, they're putting it on Twitter, they're putting it on Facebook, they're recording it all. I think many of the students are reacting the fact that, oh, this is in my neighborhood, this is something else, but more importantly is, you know, how national it's gotten.
Yeah. Let's take another call here. We'll bring in Ira calling from North St. Louis. Ira, go ahead, please.
I think one of the problems, you know, I respect Dr. Hightower, and you know, he's been a great referee, made around the country, made great decisions. But in this case, we have to understand kids nowadays are part of the social media. And the social media is kind of uncontrollable. So if these kids talk to their friends, okay, and they come to school the next day, I guess but the one question that comes to my mind, how many white teachers are in this system there that's voicing their opinion in a negative way? That question came to my mind. So actually, how many white teachers do they have in their community, on their staff, I should say? Expressing those option views.
Okay, I'm not quite sure we all have the question. Greg, Steve, Tom, did you pick up on that?
I think I kind of picked up. I think he was wondering the racial makeup of the teachers. What's the narrative? Because apparently there are two narratives, and it's developing very much now that there's a narrative from the African-American perspective that this young man was shot down in cold blood. His body was out there for 4 hours, which I think angered many people, and the seeming cover-up. And then there's also the narrative that some Caucasian Americans would have that, well, he was doing his job. He felt threatened. He felt like he needed. So I think that's what he was speaking of. Mm-hmm. What's the opinion? What opinions are being injected into to muddle the water of the facts?
Right. Let's try another call here. We'll bring in Martin calling from Potosi. Martin, go ahead.
I'm going to be a white male, and I'm going to try to expand a little bit on the talk, which I think is very, very important for young black males in today's society and might be literally life-saving for them. Now, what if they're in a family situation where maybe there's a one-parent family, one-parent household? What if our two parents, whatever, either way, and they're unequipped or unable to give the talk? I think since it's such a highly important subject that, you know, every young black male needs to be aware of, what is the role of educators in that situation? Because first is parents, but if parents can't, visit this, you know, important topic, what is, you know, the role of educators?
Okay, well, we have been talking about that. Let me go around the table. This time I'll start with Tom. Then we're going to have to wrap it up.
I think Martin brings up a good point about, you know, what is the role of an educator when it comes to things like this. And, you know, as a professional, you've got to be objective about the facts. You've got to be objective about the situation. You've got to be empathetic. And you also have to really consider all the diversity that goes into it. Kind of like what Steve was saying, you know, you get these different these different age levels that we have to attend to. We have, how do we go about talking about something? Greg has a young man in his family. He's got a son, whereas I don't have any children. So, you know, we're going to have different perspective on that. But I think the thing is that you know, as an educator, we have to have these discussions. I think you make a good point that perhaps parents aren't in some ways well-versed in the topic. I'm not saying educators are always well-versed in the topic, but I'm just saying that through, that discourse that we can have at school, that the conversations that we can have at school, I think there's a lot of growth and learning that can take place.
Anybody else have a thought before we wrap this up, Steve?
I just think that, families and educators, there needs to be an emotional partnership. There needs to be a partnership. And the dialogues come, hopefully, without too much judgmental frameworks to it. But parents are looking for partnerships. And it's our responsibility as educators to partner and to help families explore the topics.
Greg Carr, we'll give you the final word.
All right. I had the conversation last night in my class at Florissant Valley, and I explained one time when I was profiled, and I saw a physical reaction when I told them I had to hold a flashlight, a lit flashlight, to the side of my face and hold a steering wheel for 35 minutes while the police officer checked my license to see if it was mine. And she had a physical reaction. I said, I know I'm from a different generation. I said, I thought I would never say that, but I am. And so these conversations need to take place. And we need to challenge the younger generation and vice versa. They need to challenge us and have a dialogue between the generations.
Well, the challenge sometimes is to keep the conversation going after the event is over. Sometimes that does not happen. Mm-hmm. We'll have to end it there, gentlemen. Greg Carr, thanks so much for being with us. He's with Harris Stowe. Tom Lawson, a social studies teacher at McClure and in the Ferguson-Florissant District, and Steve Zwolak of the University City Children's Center. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for being with us. Good conversation. Coming up, Twitter as an educational tool and how it's being used to help teach about what's been going on in Ferguson. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.